but don't have too much, or you'll surely get drunk. Come here, boy, shouted Nikkan sharply. Yes, sir. Jotaro stood still and turned to face the abbot. Stop acting the fool. Fetch me some rocks. This kind? Asked Jotaro, snatching a stone that lay near his feet and holding it up. Yes, like that. Bring lots of them. Yes, sir. As the boy gathered the stones, Nikkan sat down and wrote on each one, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, the sacred invocation of the Nichiren sect. Then he gave them back to the boy and ordered him to scatter them among the dead. While Jotaro did this, Nikkan put his palms together and chanted a section of the Lotus Sutra. When he had finished, he announced, That should take care of them. Now you two can be on your way. I shall return to Nara. As abruptly as he had come, he departed, walking at his customary breakneck speed before Musashi had a chance to thank him or make arrangements to see him again. For a moment, Musashi just stared at the retreating figure, then suddenly he darted off to catch up with it. Reverend Priest, he called, haven't you forgotten something? He patted his sword as he said this. What? Asked Nikkan. You have given me no word of guidance, and since there is no way of knowing when we'll meet again, I'd appreciate some small bit of advice. The abbot's toothless mouth let out its familiar crackling laugh. Don't you understand yet? He asked. That you're too strong is the only thing I have to teach you. If you continue to pride yourself on your strength, you won't live to see 30. Why, you might easily have been killed today. Think about that and decide how to conduct yourself in the future. Musashi was silent. You accomplished something today, but it was not well done, not by a long shot. Since you're still young, I can't really blame you, but it's a grave error to think the way of the samurai consists of nothing but a show of strength. But then, I tend to have the same fault, so I'm not really qualified to speak to you on the subject. You should study the way that Yagyu Sekshusai and Lord Koizumi of Ise have lived. Sekshusai was my teacher. Lord Koizumi was his. If you take them as your models and try to follow the path they have followed, you may come to know the truth. When Nikkan's voice ceased, Musashi, who had been staring at the ground, deep in thought, looked up. The old priest had already vanished. The Koyagyu Fief. Yagyu Valley lies at the foot of Mount Kasagi, northeast of Nara. In the early 17th century, it was the site of a prosperous little community, too large to be described as a mere village, yet not populous or bustling enough to be called a town. It might naturally have been called Kasagi Village, but instead its inhabitants referred to their home as the Kambe Domain, a name inherited from the bygone age of the great privately owned manorial estates. In the middle of the community stood the main house, a castle that served as both a symbol of governmental stability and the cultural center of the region. Stone ramparts, reminiscent of ancient fortresses, surrounded the main house. The people of the area, as well as their lord's ancestors, had been comfortably settled there since the 10th century, and the present ruler was a country squire in the best tradition, who spread culture among his subjects and was at all times prepared to protect his territory with his life. At the same time, however, he carefully avoided any serious involvement in the wars and feuds of his fellow lords in other districts. In short, it was a peaceful fief, governed in an enlightened manner. Here one saw no traces of the depravity or degeneracy associated with footloose samurai. It was quite unlike Nara, where ancient temples celebrated in history and folklore were being left to go to seed. Disruptive elements simply were not permitted to enter into the life of this community. The setting itself militated against ugliness. The mountains in the Kasagi Range were no less strikingly beautiful at eventide than at sunrise, and the water was pure and clean. Ideal water, it was said, for making tea. The plum blossoms of Tsukigase were nearby, and nightingales sang from the season of the melting snow to that of the thunderstorms, their tones as crystal clear as the waters of the mountain streams. A poet once wrote that, in the place where a hero is born, the mountains and rivers are fresh and clear. If no hero had been born in Yagyu Valley, the poet's words would have been empty, but this was indeed a birthplace of heroes. No better proof could be offered than the lords of Yagyu themselves. In this great house, even the retainers were men of nobility. Many had come from the rice fields, distinguished themselves in battle, and gone on to become loyal and competent aides. Yagyu Muneyoshi Sekishusai, now that he'd retired, had taken up residence in a small mountain house some distance behind the main house. He no longer showed any interest in local government, and had no idea who was in direct control at the moment. He had a number of capable sons and grandsons, as well as trustworthy retainers to assist and guide them, and he was safe in assuming that the people were being as well governed as they had been when he was in charge. When Musashi arrived in this district, about 10 days had passed since the battle on Hanya Plain. On the way, he had visited some temples, Kasagidera and Joruriji, where he'd seen relics of the Kenmu era. He put up at the local inn with the intention of relaxing for a time, physically and spiritually. Dressed informally, he went out one day for a walk with Jotaro. "It's amazing," said Musashi, his eyes roving over the crops in the fields and the farmers going about their work. "Amazing," he repeated several times. Finally, Jotaro asked, "What's amazing?" For him, the most amazing thing was the way Musashi was talking to himself. "Since leaving Mimasaka, I've been in Setsu, Kawachi, and Izumi provinces, Kyoto and Nara, and I've never seen a place like this." "Well, so what? What's so different about it?" "For one thing, there are lots of trees in the mountains here." Jotaro laughed. "Trees? There are trees everywhere. Well, aren't there?" "Yes, but here it's different. All the trees in Yagyu are old. That means there haven't been any wars here, no enemy troops burning or cutting down the forests. It also means there haven't been any famines, at least for a long, long time." "That's all?" "No. The fields are green, too. And the new barley has been well trampled to strengthen the roots and make it grow well. Listen, can't you hear the sound of spinning wheels? It seems to be coming from every house. And haven't you noticed that when travelers in fine clothing pass by, the farmers don't look at them enviously?" "Anything else?" "As you can see, there are many young girls working the fields. This means that the district is well off, that life is normal here. The children are growing up healthy, the old people are treated with due respect, and the young men and women aren't running off to live uncertain lives in other places. It's a safe bet that the lord of the district is wealthy, and that the swords and guns in his armory are kept polished and in the best condition." "I don't see anything so interesting in all that," complained Jotaro. "I don't imagine you would." "Anyway, you didn't come here to admire the scenery. Aren't you going to fight the samurai in the house of Yagyu?" "Fighting isn't all there is to the art of war. The men who think that way and are satisfied to have food to eat and a place to sleep are mere vagabonds. A serious student is much more concerned with training his mind and disciplining his spirit than with developing martial skills. He has to learn about all sorts of things. Geography, irrigation, the people's feelings, their manners and customs, their relationship with the lord of their territory. He wants to know what goes on inside the castle, not just what goes on outside it. He wants, essentially, to go everywhere he can and learn everything he can. Musashi realized that this lecture probably meant little to Jotaro, but he felt it necessary to be honest with the child and not give him halfway answers. He showed no impatience at the boy's many questions, and as they walked along, he continued to give thoughtful and serious replies. After they had seen what there was to see of the exterior of Koyagyu Castle, as the main house was properly known, and taken a good look all around the valley, they started back to the inn. There was only one inn, but it was a large one. The road was a section of the Iga High Road, and many people making pilgrimages to the Jōruruji or Kasagidera stayed the night here. In the evening, 10 or 12 pack horses were always to be found tied to the trees near the entrance or under the front eaves. The maid who followed them to their room asked, "Have you been out for a walk?" In her mountain-climbing trousers, she might have been mistaken for a boy were it not for her girl's red obi. Without waiting for an answer, she said, "You can take your bath now, if you like." Musashi started for the bathroom, while Jotaro, sensing that there was a new friend of his own age, asked, "What's your name?"
"I don't know," answered the girl.
"You must be crazy if you don't know your own name."
"It's Kocha."
"That's a funny name," Jotaro laughed.
"What's funny about it?"
demanded Kocha, striking him with her fist.
"She hit me!" yelled Jotaro.
From the folded clothing on the floor of the anteroom, Musashi knew there were other people in the bath. He took off his own clothes and opened the door into the steamy bathroom. There were three men, talking jovially, but catching sight of his brawny body, they stopped as though a foreign element had been introduced into their midst. Musashi slipped into the communal bath with a contented sigh, his 6-foot frame causing the hot water to overflow. For some reason, this startled the three men, and one of them looked straight at Musashi, who had leaned his head against the edge of the pool and closed his eyes. Gradually, they took up their conversation where they had left off. They were washing themselves outside the pool. The skin on their backs was white and their muscles pliant. They were apparently city people, for their manner of speech was polished and urbane.
"What was his name, the samurai from the House of Yagyu?"
"I think he said it was Shoda Kizaemon."
"If Lord Yagyu sends a retainer to convey a refusal to a match, he can't be as good as he's said to be."
"According to Shoda, Sekishusai is retired and never fights anyone anymore."
"Do you suppose that's the truth, or was he just making it up?"
"Oh, I don't think it's true. It's much more likely that when he heard the second son of the House of Yoshioka was challenging him, he decided to play it safe."
"Well, he was tactful at least, sending fruit and saying he hoped we'd enjoy our stopover."
"Yoshioka?" Musashi lifted his head and opened his eyes. Having overheard something mention Denshichiro's trip to Ise while he was at the Yoshioka school, Musashi assumed that the three men were on their way back to Kyoto. One of them must be Denshichiro. Which one? "I don't have much luck with baths," thought Musashi ruefully. "First, Osugi tricked me into taking a bath, and now, again with no clothes on, I run into one of the Yoshiokas. He's bound to have heard of what happened at the school. If he knew my name was Miyamoto, he'd be out that door and back with his sword in no time." But the three paid him no attention. To judge from their talk, as soon as they had arrived, they had sent a letter to the House of Yagyu. Apparently, Sekishusai had had some connection with Yoshioka Kenpo back in the days when Kenpo was tutor to the shoguns. No doubt because of this, Sekishusai could not let Kenpo's son go away without acknowledging his letter and had therefore sent Shoda to pay a courtesy call at the inn. In response to this, the best these city youths could say was that Sekishusai was tactful, that he had decided to play it safe, and that he couldn't be as good as he's said to be. They seemed exceedingly satisfied with themselves, but Musashi thought them ridiculous. In contrast to what he had seen of Koyagyu Castle and the enviable state of the area's inhabitants, they appeared to have nothing better to offer than clever conversation. It reminded him of a saying about the frog at the bottom of a well, unable to see what was going on in the outside world. Sometimes, he was thinking, it works the other way around. These pampered young sons of Kyoto were in a position to see what was happening at the center of things and to know what was going on everywhere, but it would not have occurred to them that while they were watching the great open sea, somewhere else, at the bottom of a deep well, a frog was steadily growing larger and stronger. Here in Koyagyu, well away from the country's political and economic center, sturdy samurai had for decades been leading a healthy rural life, preserving the ancient virtues, correcting their weak points, and growing in stature. With the passage of time, Koyagyu had produced Yagyu Muneyoshi, a great master of the martial arts, and his son, Lord Munenori of Tajima, whose prowess had been recognized by Ieyasu himself. And there were also Muneyoshi's older sons, Gorozaemon and Toshikatsu, famous throughout the land for their bravery, and his grandson, Hyogo Toshitoshi, whose prodigious feats had earned him a highly paid position under the renowned general Kato Kiyomasa of Higo. In fame and prestige, the House of Yagyu did not rank with the House of Yoshioka, but in terms of ability, the difference was a thing of the past. Denshichiro and his companions were blind to their own arrogance. Musashi, nevertheless, felt a little sorry for them. He went over to a corner where water was piped into the room. Undoing his headband, he seized a handful of clay and began scrubbing his scalp. For the first time in many weeks, he treated himself to the luxury of a good shampoo. In the meantime, the men from Kyoto were finishing their bath.
Ah, that felt good. Indeed it did. Now why don't we have some girls in to pour our sake for us? Splendid idea, splendid.
The three finished drying themselves and left. After a thorough wash and another soak in the hot water, Musashi too dried off, tied up his hair, and went back to his room. There he found the boyish-looking Kocha in tears.
What happened to you?
It's that boy of yours, sir. Look where he hit me.
That's a lie,
Jotaro cried angrily from the opposite corner. Musashi was about to scold him, but Jotaro protested.
The dope said you were weak.
That's not true. I didn't.
You did too.
Sir, I didn't say you or anybody else was weak. This brat started bragging about how you were the greatest swordsman in the country because you'd killed dozens of ronin at Hanya Plain, and I said there wasn't anybody in Japan better with the sword than the lord of this district. And then he started slapping me on the cheeks.
Musashi laughed.
I see. He shouldn't have done that, and I'll give him a good scolding. I hope you'll forgive us.
Joe,
he said sternly.
Yes, sir,
said the boy, still sulking.
Go take a bath.
I don't like to take baths.
Neither do I, Musashi lied. But you're so sweaty, you stink.
I'll go swimming in the river tomorrow morning.
The boy was becoming more and more stubborn as he grew more accustomed to Musashi. But Musashi did not really mind. In fact, he rather liked this side of Jotaro. In the end, the boy did not go to the bath. Before long, Kocha brought the dinner trays. They ate in silence, Jotaro and the maid glaring at each other while she served the meal. Musashi was preoccupied with his private objective of meeting Sekishusai. Considering his own lowly status, perhaps this was asking too much, but maybe, just maybe, it was possible. If I'm going to match arms with anybody, thought Musashi, it should be with somebody strong. It's worth risking my life to see whether I can overcome the great Yagyu name. There's no use in following the way of the sword if I haven't the courage to try. Musashi was aware that most people would laugh outright at him for entertaining the idea. Yagyu, though not one of the more prominent daimyo, was the master of a castle. His son was at the shogun's court, and the whole family was steeped in the traditions of the warrior class. In the new age now dawning, they were riding the crest of the times. This will be the true test, thought Musashi, who even as he ate his rice was preparing himself for the encounter. The Peony. The old man's dignity had grown with the years, until now he resembled nothing so much as a majestic crane, while at the same time retaining the appearance and manner of the well-bred samurai. His teeth were sound, his eyes wonderfully sharp. "I'll live to be 100, he frequently assured everyone. Sekishusai firmly believed this himself. "The house of Yagyu has always been long-lived," he liked to point out. "The ones who died in their 20s and 30s were killed in battle. All the others lived well beyond 60. Among the countless wars he himself had taken part in were several major ones, including the revolt of the Miyoshi and the battles marking the rise and fall of the Matsunaga and Oda families. Even if Sekishusai had not been born in such a family, his way of life, and especially his attitude after he reached old age, gave reason to believe he would live to reach 100. At the age of 47, he had decided for personal reasons to give up warfare. Nothing since had altered this resolution. He had turned a deaf ear to the entreaties of the shogun Ashikaga Yoshiaki, as well as to repeated requests from Nobunaga and Hideyoshi to join forces with them. Though he lived almost in the shadow of Kyoto and Osaka, he refused to become embroiled in the frequent battles of those centers of power and intrigue. He preferred to remain in Yagyu, like a bear in a cave, and tend his 15,000-bushel estate in such a way that it could be handed on to his descendants in good condition. Sekishusai once remarked, "I've done well to hold on to this estate. In this uncertain age, when leaders rise today and fall tomorrow, it's almost incredible that this one small castle has managed to survive intact." This was no exaggeration. If he had supported Yoshiaki, he would have fallen victim to Nobunaga, and if he had supported Nobunaga, he might well have run afoul of Hideyoshi. Had he accepted Hideyoshi's patronage, he would have been dispossessed by Ieyasu after the Battle of Sekigahara. His perspicacity, which people admired, was one factor, but to survive in such turbulent times, Sekishusai had to have an inner fortitude lacking in the ordinary samurai of his time. They were all too apt to side with a man one day and shamelessly desert him the next to look after their own interests, with no thought to propriety or integrity, or even to slaughter their own kinsmen should they interfere with personal ambitions. "I am unable to do things like that," Sekishusai said simply. And he was telling the truth. However, he had not renounced the art of war itself. In the alcove of his living room hung a poem he had written himself. It said, "I have no clever method for doing well in life. I rely only on the art of war. It is my final refuge." When he was invited by Ieyasu to visit Kyoto, Sekishusai found it impossible not to accept and emerged from decades of serene seclusion to make his first visit to the shogun's court. With him, he took his fifth son, Munenori, who was 24, and his grandson, Hyogo, then only 16. Ieyasu not only confirmed the venerable old warrior in his land holdings, but asked him to become tutor in the martial arts to the house of Tokugawa. Sekishusai, declining the honor on grounds of age, requested that Munenori be appointed in his stead, and this met with Ieyasu's approval. The legacy Munenori carried with him to Edo encompassed more than a superb ability in martial arts, for his father had also passed on to him a knowledge of the higher plane of the art of war that enables a leader to govern wisely. In Sekishusai's view, the art of war was certainly a means of governing the people, but it was also a means of controlling the self. This he had learned from Lord Koizumi, who, he was fond of saying, was the protective deity of the Yagyu household. The certificate Lord Koizumi had given him to attest to his mastery of the Shinkage style of swordsmanship was always kept on a shelf in Sekishusai's room, along with a four-volume manual of military techniques presented him by his lordship. On anniversaries of Lord Koizumi's death, Sekishusai never neglected to place an offering of food before these treasured possessions. In addition to descriptions of the hidden sword techniques of the Shinkage style, the manual contained illustrative pictures, all by the hand of Lord Koizumi himself. Even in his retirement, Sekishusai took pleasure in rolling the scrolls out and looking through them. He was constantly surprised to rediscover how skillfully his teacher had wielded the brush. The pictures showed people fighting and fencing in every conceivable position and stance. When Sekishusai looked at them, he felt that the swordsmen were about to descend from heaven to join him in his little mountain house. Lord Koizumi had first come to Koyagyu Castle when Sekishusai was 37 or 38 and still brimming with military ambition. His lordship, together with two nephews, Hikida Bungoro and Suzuki Ihaku, was going around the country seeking experts in the martial arts, and one day he arrived at the Hozoin. This was in the days when Inye often called at Koyagyu Castle, and Inye told Sekishusai about the visitor. That was the beginning of their relationship. Sekishusai and Koizumi held matches for 3 days in a row. In the first bout, Koizumi announced where he would attack, then proceeded to take the match, doing exactly as he had said. The same thing happened the second day, and Sekishusai, his pride injured, concentrated on figuring out a new approach for the third day. Upon seeing his new stance, Koizumi merely said, "That won't do. If you are going to do that, I will do this." Without further ado, he attacked and defeated Sekishusai for the third time. From that day on, Sekishusai gave up the egotistic approach to swordsmanship. As he later recalled, it was on that occasion that he first had a glimpse of the true art of war. At Sekishusai's strong urging, Lord Koizumi remained at Koyagyu for 6 months, during which time Sekishusai studied with the single-minded devotion of a neophyte. When they finally parted, Lord Koizumi said, "My way of swordsmanship is still imperfect. You are young, and you should try to carry it to perfection." He then gave Sekishusai a Zen riddle. "What is sword fighting without a sword?" For a number of years, Sekishusai pondered this, considering it from every angle and finally arriving at an answer that satisfied him. When Lord Koizumi came to visit again, Sekishusai greeted him with clear, untroubled eyes and suggested that they have a match. His lordship scrutinized him for a moment, then said, "No, it would be useless. You have discovered the truth." He then presented Sekishusai with the certificate and the 4-volume manual, and in this fashion, the Yagyu style was born. This, in turn, gave birth to Sekishusai's peaceful way of life in his old age. That Sekishusai lived in a mountain house was due to his no longer liking the imposing castle with all its elaborate trappings. Despite his almost Taoist love of seclusion, he was happy to have the company of the girl Shoda Kizaemon had brought to play the flute for him, for she was thoughtful, polite, and never a nuisance. Not only did her playing please him immensely, but she added a welcome touch of youth and femininity to the household. Occasionally, she would talk of leaving, but he would always tell her to stay a little longer. Putting the finishing touches on the single peony he was arranging in an iga vase, Sekishusai asked Otsu,
"What do you think? Is my flower arrangement alive?"
Standing just behind him, she said,
"You must have studied flower arranging very hard."
"Not at all. I'm not a Kyoto nobleman, and I've never studied either flower arranging or the tea ceremony under a teacher."
"Well, it looks as though you had."
"I use the same method with flowers that I use with the sword."
Otsu looked surprised.
"Can you really arrange flowers the way you use the sword?"
"Yes. You see, it's all a matter of spirit. I have no use for rules. Twisting the flowers with your fingertips or choking them at the neck. The point is to have the proper spirit, to be able to make them seem alive, just as they were when they were picked. Look at that. My flower isn't dead."
Otsu felt that this austere old man had taught her many things she needed to know, and since it had all begun with a chance meeting on the high road, she felt she had been very lucky.
"I'll teach you the tea ceremony," he would say. "Or, do you compose Japanese poems? If you do, teach me something about the courtly style. The manyoshu is all well and good, but living here in this secluded place, I'd rather hear simple poems about nature."
In return, she did little things for him that no one else thought of. He was delighted, for example, when she made him a little cloth cap like the tea masters wore. He kept it on his head much of the time now, treasuring it as though there were nothing finer anywhere. Her flute playing, too, pleased him immensely, and on moonlit nights the hauntingly beautiful sound of her flute often reached as far as the castle itself. While Sekishusai and Otsu were discussing the flower arrangement, Kizaemon came quietly to the entrance of the mountain house and called to Otsu. She came out and invited him in, but he hesitated.
"Would you let his lordship know I've just come back from my errand?" he asked.
Otsu laughed.
"That's backwards, isn't it?"
"Why?"
"You're the chief retainer here. I'm only an outsider, called in to play the flute. You're much closer to him than I. Shouldn't you go to him directly rather than through me?"
"I suppose you're right, but here in his lordship's little house, you're special. Anyway, please give him the message."
Kizaemon, too, was pleased by the way things had turned out. He had found in Otsu a person whom his master liked very much. Otsu returned almost immediately to say that Sekishusai wanted Kizaemon to come in. Kizaemon found the old man in the tea room, wearing the cloth cap Otsu had made.
"Are you back already?"
asked Sekishusai.
"Yes. I called on them and gave them the letter and the fruit, just as you instructed."
"Have they gone?"
"No. No sooner had I arrived back here than a messenger came from the inn with a letter. It said that since they'd come to Yagyu, they didn't want to leave without seeing the dojo. If possible, they'd like to come tomorrow. They also said they'd like to meet you and pay their respects."
"Impudent boors! Why must they be such a nuisance?"
Sekishusai looked extremely annoyed. Did you explain that Munenori is in Edo, Hyogo in Kumamoto, and that there's no one else around?
I did.
I despise people like that. Even after I send a messenger to tell them I can't see them, they try to push their way in.
I don't know what...
It would appear that Yoshioka's sons are as shiftless as they're said to be.
The one at the Wataya is Denshichiro. He didn't impress me.
I'd be surprised if he did. His father was a man of considerable character. When I went to Kyoto with Lord Koizumi, we saw him two or three times and drank some sake together. It appears that the house has gone downhill since then. The young man seems to think that being Kenpo's son gives him the right not to be refused entry here, and so he's pressing his challenge. But from our viewpoint, it makes no sense to accept the challenge and then send him away beaten.
This Denshichiro seems to have a good deal of self-confidence. If he wants so badly to come, perhaps I myself should take him on.
No, don't even consider it.
These sons of famous people usually have a high opinion of themselves. Moreover, they're prone to try and twist things to their own advantage.
If you were to beat him, you can depend on it that he'd try to destroy our reputation in Kyoto. As far as I'm concerned, it makes no difference, but I don't want to burden Munenori or Hyogo with something like that.
What should we do, then?
The best thing would be to appease him in some way, make him feel he's being treated the way a son from a great house should be treated. Maybe it was a mistake to send a man to see him.
Shifting his gaze to Otsu, he continued,
I think a woman would be better. Otsu is probably just the right person.
All right, she said. Do you want me to go now?
No, there's no hurry. Tomorrow morning will do.
Sekishusai quickly wrote a simple letter, of the sort a tea master might compose, and handed it to Otsu with a peony like the one he had put in the vase.
Give these to him, and tell him that you've come in my stead because I have a cold. Let's see what his answer is.
The next morning, Otsu draped a long veil over her head. Although veils were already out of style in Kyoto, even among the higher classes, the upper and middle class women in the provinces still prized them. At the stable, which was in the outer grounds of the castle, she asked to borrow a horse. The keeper of the stables, who was busy cleaning up, asked,
Oh, are you going somewhere?
Yes, I have to go to the Wataya on an errand for his lordship.
Shall I go with you?
There's no need for that.
Will you be all right?
Of course. I like horses. The ones I used to ride in Mimasaka were wild, or nearly so.
As she rode off, the reddish-brown veil floated in the wind behind her. She rode well, holding the letter and the slightly weary peony in one hand and deftly handling the horse with the other. Farmers and workers in the field waved to her, for in the short time she had been here, she had already become fairly well known among the local people, whose relations with Sekishusai were much friendlier than were usual between lord and peasants. The farmers here all knew that a beautiful young woman had come to play the flute for their lord, and their admiration and respect for him were extended to Otsu. Arriving at the Wataya, she dismounted and tied her horse to a tree in the garden.
Welcome, called Kocha, coming out to greet her. Are you staying for the night?
No, I've just come from Koyagyu Castle with a message for Yoshioka Denshichiro. He's still here, isn't he?
Would you wait a moment, please?
In the brief time Kocha was gone, Otsu created a mild stir among the travelers who were noisily putting on their leggings and sandals and strapping their luggage to their backs.
Who's that? Asked one. Who do you suppose she's come to see?
Otsu's beauty, a graceful elegance seldom encountered in the country, kept the departing guests whispering and ogling until she followed Kocha out of sight. Denshiro and his companions, having drunk until late the night before, had only just arisen. When told that a messenger had come from the castle, they assumed it would be the man who had come the day before. The sight of Otsu with her white peony came as a distinct surprise.
"Oh, please forgive the room. It's a mess."
With abjectly apologetic faces, they straightened their kimonos and sat properly and a little stiffly on their knees.
"Please, come in, come in."
"I've been sent by the Lord of Koyagyu Castle," Otsu said simply, placing the letter and the peony before Denshiro. "Would you be so kind as to read the letter now?"
"Ah, yes. This is the letter? Yes, I'll read it."
He opened the scroll, which was no more than a foot long. Written in thin ink, suggestive of the light flavor of tea, it said,
"Forgive me for sending my greetings in a letter, rather than meeting you in person, but unfortunately I have a slight cold. I think a pure white peony will give you more pleasure than the runny nose of an old man. I send the flower by the hand of a flower, with the hope that you will accept my apology. My ancient body rests outside the everyday world. I hesitate to show my face. Please smile with pity on an old man."
Denshiro sniffed with contempt and rolled up the letter.
"Is that all?"
he asked.
"No. He also said that although he'd like to have a cup of tea with you, he hesitates to invite you to his house because there is no one there but warriors ignorant of the niceties of tea. Since Munenori is away in Edo, he feels that the serving of the tea would be so crude as to bring laughter to the lips of people from the imperial capital. He asked me to beg your pardon and tell you that he hopes to see you on some future occasion."
"Aha!"
exclaimed Denshiro, putting on a suspicious face.
"If I understand you correctly, Sekishusai is under the impression we were looking forward to observing the niceties of the tea ceremony. To tell the truth, being from samurai families, we don't know anything about tea. Our intention was to inquire personally after Sekishusai's health and persuade him to give us a lesson in swordsmanship."
"He understands that perfectly, of course. But he's spending his old age in retirement and has acquired the habit of expressing many of his thoughts in terms of tea."
In obvious disgust, Denshiro replied,
"Well, he hasn't left us any choice but to give up. Please tell him that if we come again, we'd like to see him."
He handed the peony back to Otsu.
"Don't you like it? He thought it might cheer you up on the road. He said you might hang it in the corner of your palanquin, or, if you're on horseback, attach it to your saddle."
"He meant it to be a souvenir?"
Denshiro lowered his eyes as though insulted, then, with a sour face, said,
"This is ridiculous. You can tell him we have peonies of our own in Kyoto."
If that was the way he felt, Otsu decided, there was no point in pressing the gift on him. Promising to deliver his message, she took her leave as delicately as she would have removed the bandage from an open sore. In ill temper, her hosts barely acknowledged her departure. Once in the hallway, Otsu laughed softly to herself, glanced at the shiny black floor leading to the room where Musashi was staying, and turned in the other direction. Kocha came out of Musashi's room and ran to catch up with her.
"Are you leaving already?"
she asked.
"Yes, I've finished what I came to do."
"My, that was fast, wasn't it?"
Looking down at Otsu's hand, she asked,
"Is that a peony? I didn't know they bloomed white." "Yes, it's from the castle garden. You can have it if you like."
"Oh, please," said Kocha, stretching out her hands. After bidding Otsu goodbye, Kocha went to the servants' quarters and showed everyone the flower. Since no one was inclined to admire it, she went disappointedly back to Musashi's room. Musashi, sitting by the window with his chin in his hands, was gazing in the direction of the castle and thinking hard about his objective. How could he manage, first, to meet Sekishusai, and second, to overcome him with his sword?
Do you like flowers?
Kocha asked as she entered.
Flowers?
She showed him the peony.
It's nice.
Do you like it?
Yes.
It's supposed to be a peony, a white peony.
Is it? Why don't you put it in that vase over there?
I don't know how to arrange flowers. You do it.
No, you do it. It's better to do it without thinking how it's going to look.
Well, I'll go and get some water, she said, taking the vase out with her.
Musashi's eye happened to light on the cut end of the peony stem. His head tilted in surprise, though he couldn't pinpoint what it was that attracted his attention. Casual interest had become intense scrutiny by the time Kocha came back. She put the vase in the alcove and tried sticking the peony in it, but with poor results.
The stem's too long, said Musashi. Bring it here, I'll cut it. Then when you stand it up, it'll look natural.
Kocha brought the flower over and held it up to him. Before she knew what had happened, she had dropped the flower and burst into tears. Small wonder, for in that split second, Musashi had whipped out his short sword, uttered a vigorous cry, slashed through the stem between her hands, and resheathed his sword. To Kocha, the glint of steel and the sound of the sword snapping back into its scabbard seemed simultaneous. Making no attempt to comfort the terrified girl, Musashi picked up the piece of stem he had cut off and began comparing one end of it with the other. He seemed completely absorbed. Finally, taking notice of her distraught state, he apologized and patted her on the head. Once he had coaxed her out of her tears, he asked, "Do you know who cut this flower?"
"No, it was given to me."
"By whom?"
"A person from the castle."
"One of the samurai?"
"No, it was a young woman."
"Then you think the flower came from the castle?"
"Yes, she said it did."
"I'm sorry I scared you. If I buy you some cakes later, will you forgive me? In any case, the flower should be just right now. Try putting it in the vase."
"Will this do?"
"Yes, that's fine."
Kocha had taken an instant liking to Musashi, but the flash of his sword had chilled her to the marrow. She left the room, unwilling to return until her duties made it absolutely unavoidable. Musashi was far more fascinated by the 8-inch piece of stem than by the flower in the alcove. He was sure the first cut had not been made with either scissors or a knife. Since peony stems are lithe and supple, the cut could only have been made with a sword, and only a very determined stroke could have made so clean a slice. Whoever had done it was no ordinary person. Although he himself had just tried to duplicate the cut with his own sword, upon comparing both ends, he was immediately aware that his own cut was by far the inferior one. It was like the difference between a Buddhist statue carved by an expert and one made by a craftsman of average skill. He asked himself what it could mean. If a samurai working the castle garden can make a cut like this, then the standards of the House of Yagyu must be even higher than I thought. His confidence suddenly deserted him. I am nowhere near ready yet. Gradually, however, he recovered from this feeling. In any event, the Yagyu people are worthy opponents. If I should lose, I can fall at their feet and accept defeat with good grace. I've already decided I'm willing to face anything, even death. Sitting and mustering up his courage, he felt himself grow warmer. But how was he going to go about it? Even if a student arrived at his doorstep with a proper introduction, it seemed unlikely Sekishusai would agree to a match. The innkeeper had said as much. And with Munenori and Hyogo both away, there was no one to challenge but Sekishusai himself. He again tried to devise a way of gaining admittance to the castle. His eyes returned to the flower in the alcove, and the image of someone the flower unconsciously reminded him of began to take form. Seeing Otsu's face in his mind's eye quieted his spirit and soothed his nerves. Otsu herself was well on her way back to Koyagyu Castle when suddenly she heard a raucous shout behind her. She turned to see a child emerging from a clump of trees at the base of a cliff. He was clearly coming after her, and since children of the area were much too timid to accost a young woman such as herself, she brought her horse to a halt out of sheer curiosity. Jotaro was stark naked. His hair was wet, and his clothes were rolled up in a ball under his arm. Unabashed by his nudity, he said, "You're the lady with the flute. Are you still staying here?" Having eyed the horse with distaste, he looked directly at Otsu. "It's you!" she exclaimed, before averting her eyes in embarrassment. "The little boy who was crying on the Yamato High Road."
"Crying? I wasn't crying."
"Never mind. How long have you been here?"
"Just came the other day."
"By yourself?"
"No, with my teacher."
"Oh, that's right. You did say you were studying swordsmanship, didn't you? What are you doing with your clothes off?"
"You don't think I'd jump in the river with my clothes on, do you?"
"River? But the water must be freezing.
People around here would laugh at the idea of going swimming this time of year." "I wasn't swimming. I was taking a bath. My teacher said I smelled sweaty, so I went to the river."
Otsu chuckled. "Where are you staying?"
"At the Wataya."
"Why? I've just come from there."
"Too bad you didn't come to see us. How about coming back with me now?"
"I can't now. I have an errand to do."
"Well, bye,"
he said, turning to go. "Jotaro, come see me at the castle sometime."
"Could I really?"
The words were barely out before Otsu began to regret them, but she said, "Yes, but make sure you don't come dressed the way you are now."
"If that's the way you feel about it, I don't want to go. I don't like places where they make a fuss about things."
Otsu felt relieved and still had a smile on her face when she rode back through the castle gate. After returning her horse to the stable, she went to report to Sekishusai. He laughed and said,
"So they were angry. Fine, let them be angry. There's nothing they can do about it."
After a moment, he seemed to remember something else.
"Did you throw the peony away?"
he asked. She explained that she had given it to the maid at the inn, and he nodded his approval.
"Did the Yoshioka boy take the peony in his hand and look at it?"
he asked.
"Yes, when he read the letter."
"And?"
"He just handed it back to me." "He didn't look at the stem?"
"Not that I noticed."
"He didn't examine it or say anything about it?"
"No."
"It's just as well that I refuse to meet him. He's not worth meeting. The house of Yoshioka might just as well have ended with Kenpo."
The Yagyu Dojo could quite appropriately be described as grand. Situated in the outer grounds of the castle, it had been rebuilt around the time when Sekishusai was 40, and the sturdy timber used in its construction gave it an air of indestructibility. The gloss of the wood, acquired over the years, seemed to echo the rigors of the men who had undergone training here, and the building was ample enough to have served as samurai barracks during times of war.
"Lightly! Not with your sword point! With your gut! Your gut!"
Shoda Kizaemon, seated on a slightly elevated platform and clad in underrobe and hakama, was roaring angry instructions at two aspiring swordsmen.
"Do it again! You don't have it right at all!"
The target of Kizaemon's scolding was a pair of Yagyu samurai, who, though dazed and bathed in sweat, fought doggedly on. Stances were taken, weapons readied, and the two came together again like fire against fire.
"Ow! Yeah!"
At Yagyu, beginners were not allowed to use wooden swords. Instead, they used a staff devised specifically for the Shinkage style. a long, thin leather bag filled with strips of bamboo. It was, in effect, a leather stick with no handle or sword guard. Though less dangerous than a wooden sword, it could still remove an ear or turn a nose into a pomegranate. There were no restrictions regarding what part of the body a combatant could attack. Knocking down an opponent by striking him horizontally in the legs was permitted, and there was no rule against hitting a man once he was down.
"Keep it up! Keep at it! Same as last time!"
Kizaimon drove the student on. The custom here was not to let a man quit until he was ready to drop. Beginners were driven especially hard, never praised, and treated to no small amount of verbal abuse. Because of this, the average samurai knew that entering into the service of the House of Yagyu was not something to be taken lightly. Newcomers rarely lasted long, and the men now serving under Yagyu were the result of very careful sifting. Even the common foot soldiers and stablemen had made some progress in the study of swordsmanship. Shoda Kizaemon was, needless to say, an accomplished swordsman, having mastered the Shinkage style at an early age, and under the tutelage of Sekishusai himself, gone on to learn the secrets of the Yagyu style. To this, he had added some personal techniques of his own, and he spoke proudly now of the true Shoda style. The Yagyu horse trainer, Kimura Sukekuro, was also an adept, as was Murata Yozo, who, though employed as keeper of the storehouse, was said to have been a good match for Hyogo. Debuchi Magobe, another relatively minor official, had studied swordsmanship from childhood and wielded a powerful weapon indeed. The Lord of Echizen had tried to persuade Debuchi to come into his service, and the Tokugawas of Kii had tried to lure Murata away, but both of them had chosen to stay in Yagyu, though the material benefits were fewer. The House of Yagyu, now enjoying a peak in its fortunes, was turning out a seemingly unending stream of great swordsmen. By the same token, the Yagyu samurai were not recognized as swordsmen until they had proved their ability by surviving the merciless regimen.
"You there!"
called Kizaemon to a guard passing by outside. He had been surprised by the sight of Jotaro following along after the soldier.
"Hello!"
shouted Jotaro in his friendliest manner.
"What are you doing inside the castle?"
asked Kizaemon sternly. "The man at the gate brought me in," answered Jotaro, truthfully enough.
"He did he?"
To the guard he said,
"Why did you bring this boy here?"
"He said he wanted to see you."
"Do you mean to say you brought this child here on his word alone? Boy?"
"Yes, sir."
"This is no playground. Get along with you."
"But I didn't come to play. I brought a letter from my teacher."
"From your teacher? Didn't you say he was one of those wandering students?"
"Look at the letter, please."
"I don't need to."
"What's the matter? Can't you read?"
Kizaemon snorted.
"Well, if you can read, read it."
"You're a tricky brat. The reason I said I don't need to read it is that I already know what it says."
"Even so, wouldn't it be more polite to read it?"
"Student warriors swarm here like mosquitoes and maggots. If I took time to be polite to all of them, I wouldn't be able to do anything else. I feel sorry for you, however, so I'll tell you what the letter says, all right? It says that the writer would like to be allowed to see our magnificent dojo, that he would like to bask, even for a minute, in the shadow of the greatest master in the land, and that for the sake of all those successors who will follow the way of the sword, he would be grateful to have a lesson bestowed upon him. I imagine that's about the long and short of it."
Jotaro's eyes rounded. "Is that what the letter says?"
"Yes, so I don't need to read it, do I? Let it not be said, however, that the House of Yagyu cold-heartedly turns away those who call upon it."
He paused and continued, as though having rehearsed the speech.
"Ask the guard there to explain everything to you.
When student warriors come to this house, they enter through the main gate and proceed to the middle gate, to the right of which is a building called the Shingindo. It is identified by a hanging wooden plaque. If they apply to the caretaker there, they are free to rest for a time, and there are facilities for them to stop over for a night or two. When they leave, they are given a small amount of money to help them along the way.